This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Coming up, the coronavirus had caused people in authority to take measures they've never even considered before, like letting lots of folks out of prison. We'll hear from a district attorney who's allowing 40% of his city's prisoners to ride out the epidemic at home. A Black scholar says Black kids are kicked out of class in obscene numbers because slavery and Jim Crow are alive and well in the nation's schools. And we'll hear how racism was behind the coup that ousted Bolivia's first indigenous president. But first, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has promised not to bring any more inmates into his state's prison system due to the coronavirus epidemic. But Alan Mills, executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center, says the prisons are already infected and the state needs to free many more inmates from being trapped in a cage with the disease.
In the state prison system, they are beginning to release some people. The governor has commuted 17 sentences, and they have let out about 500 people, and I'll give you the exact number in a minute, through a variety of other means, mostly people who were within the last 6 months of their sentence being over, and they just gave them 6 months of good time so they could leave today rather than 6 months from now. So that's been the majority of people that have gotten out. I can break down for you the exact numbers. So he's commuted 17. They've given back sentencing credit to 435 people, and then they put 23 people onto electronic detention, electronic home monitoring.
But you suggested early on that about 13,000 inmates could be let loose without creating any danger to public safety.
And I still believe that. So as I said, they have gotten started, but the reason that we are proceeding with our action in the federal court is that we believe that the scope of the releases is way too small and way too slow. The governor last week issued an emergency order expanding the number of prisoners who could be allowed out on medical furlough. In that order, he made it very clear that the reason he was doing it is because there are some people who are at severe risk, particularly in a prison environment, of not only contracting COVID-19, but of having a much more serious case of it, and in some cases, obviously, death. We've currently had, according to the defendants, 4 deaths in Stateville of prisoners from COVID-19. But despite that action by the governor, the number of medical furloughs that had actually been granted was still 0. So that is very disturbing to us. And in addition, they haven't let out anybody on home confinement, which is the main way that we think an awful lot of people get out. Anybody with a low-level felony and anybody who has less than a year to serve who's over 55 can be allowed out on home confinement, which is obviously a much safer place to be than it would be were they in prison.
Now, there are about 5,500 inmates in the Cook County facility. I know you don't have an action pending against them, but I'm sure you've been observing what's gone on there.
I certainly have, and good friends of mine did bring the action. So again, they haven't let out nobody, but again, the numbers are far smaller than they ought to be. Even Tom Dart says that about a quarter of the people who are still left in the prison are there for nonviolent crimes. I see no reason in the world why those people aren't home, but I don't believe in the so-called violent crime, nonviolent crime distinction. First of all, it's important to remember everybody in Cook County Jail who's still there is only charged with something. They haven't actually been found guilty of anything, and they're presumed innocent. But even talking in the prison situation where they are found guilty, people who have convictions for so-called violent crimes are, in fact, the people that have the lowest recidivism rate among all offenders in the Department of Corrections. And people who have some of those so-called nonviolent crimes, like, for example, drug crimes, tend to have the highest recidivism rate. So the distinction between violent and nonviolent is not nearly as clear as the sheriff would have us think.
Many people in the prison reform movement now identify themselves as abolitionists, that is, seeking to abolish prisons as we know them. But I suppose that the reaction of the prison complex to appeals to downsize, at least during the coronavirus crisis, gives us some idea of the kind of resistance to abolition that we will see.
Sure, absolutely. But I think, you know, even those of us that don't identify as abolitionists, and to be clear, the Uptown People's Law Center does not. Some people who work here definitely do, but the Uptown People's Law Center does not. But, you know, our position is you could safely reach 75% of the people, and then we'll be happy to have a conversation about what should happen to the last 25%. Do they need to be in a prison as it's currently structured? I think absolutely not. Do they need to be separated from society some way? Some of them. But that doesn't mean you have to put them in what we think of as a prison right now. So what I think what you're seeing is pushback to really any significant decarceration by prison officials and by elected officials. As you pointed out earlier, we're talking about a handful of people that have been released from both the county and the state prison system. We're nowhere near talking about abolishing either of those systems. And certainly in the state system, what we're talking about isn't actually letting anybody go at all. What we're talking about is transferring them to someplace that can be safe during this crisis. That's all we've asked them to do. We haven't said send them home and never bring them back. Some people have very long sentences, and if they go out and they are safe during this environment, once it clears up in, I don't know how long, 6 months, then in theory, the Department of Corrections is free to take them back. It's no different than if somebody breaks their leg and they're taken out to an outside hospital. It doesn't mean that their sentence is over. It means that they have to be somewhere else to get appropriate medical care.
And even if 75% of prison and jail inmates were released, the U.S. would still have a bigger proportion of its population in prison than when mass black incarceration began. Most of us date that around 1970.
Right. We would still have a much larger system than we had back in 1970. And what too many young people have no idea and no memory of is that in the late 60s, we had a real fight in this country as to whether or not prisons had outlived their usefulness. There was a real fight about whether or not they should be abolished back then, when we had a tiny fraction, a sixth or seventh of what we have now in prison. Back then, there was a real discussion of whether or not we should just let people go and save prisons for 1 or 2% of the population, some tiny percent that needed to be separated. And people have forgotten that that conversation was going on. And instead, we have multiplied by 7 times the number of people we put in prison. So the idea that somehow rolling this back to where we were in 1970 is outrageous and unthinkable is ridiculous. The society is no safer now than it was in 1968, before all this started.
Healthcare in prison is woefully inadequate across the board. Is this coronavirus crisis a learning or teaching moment for prison health?
Well, no, not in Illinois anyway. You know, we've sued over the last 10 years about how bad the Illinois medical system was. And last spring, we had a consent decree that was entered, and we had envisioned a 10-year time frame, or it would take 10 years to bring the system up to constitutional minimums. Instead, we have now a crisis less than a year later. So I don't think it's a teaching moment so much as an absolute disaster. I'm sorry, I can't think of something where we put hundreds of people's lives at stake and thousands of people at risk of getting very seriously ill as a teaching moment. It's a disaster. I don't want to downplay this and call it a teaching moment. It's not. It's also, I need to say this, that what happens in prison doesn't stay in prison. Leaving aside any early releases, there are thousands of people that walk in and out of the prison system every week. That includes staff. And that includes, in Illinois, about 300 prisoners per week who we release because their sentences are up. So those people are all going to come back to the community. The ones that we release from prison are disproportionately coming back to generally impoverished black and brown communities in urban areas. And the only question is, are we going to release them with or without the virus? And the entire public would be better off if we release them before the pandemic spread throughout the prison system. It'd be much better to release all those people in the community healthy than sick and infectious. And many of these prisons are located not in urban areas, but in rural areas. And I always like to point to Menard Correctional Center, way down in southern Illinois, in the town of Chester. The town of Chester has 2 ICU beds. Menard has 2,000 prisoners. The entire county that Chester is located in has 2 ICU beds. So should this pandemic spread throughout Menard, it would be a public health disaster, not just for the prison, but for the entire community.
That was Attorney Alan Mills, Executive Director of the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago. Chesa Boudin, the leftist district attorney for San Francisco, has a personal interest in dramatically reducing the U.S. prison population. His father is a 75-year-old prison inmate serving time for his role in the 1981 Brinks armored car robbery, a political heist by white radicals and members of the Black Liberation Army. District Attorney Boudin told National Public Radio's Terry Gross that he's reduced the San Francisco jail's population by 40%, both to fight the COVID-19 epidemic and because this country puts too many people in jail.
We've taken bold, aggressive action to make sure that there is not an outbreak in the San Francisco County Jail. San Francisco and the Bay Area, I think we're way ahead of the curve nationally in terms of taking bold measures to prevent the spread of the disease. And the same is true within San Francisco's county jail. As district attorney, public safety is my primary responsibility. And right now, we recognize that the single biggest threat to public safety in San Francisco, as across the globe, is COVID-19. And what we need to do is let medical professionals guide public policy. It's what I wish the President of the United States would do, and it's what I'm trying to do to the extent possible with the San Francisco County Jail and criminal justice system. The Director of Jail Medical has made it very clear in writing and repeatedly that we need to reduce the jail population in order to avert disaster. And she's even given us a target number that she wants us to reduce the jail population to. What we've done is we've reduced the county jail population since I took office in January by nearly 40%. That has created the conditions for the jail medical team to implement some level of social distancing, to isolate people who are incarcerated who show symptoms, to find ways to actually meet the medical needs of folks who have other medical conditions besides COVID-19 who are housed in the jail. And in doing so, at least to date, we have managed to avert what could be a really catastrophic outcome. No one wants short-term pretrial incarceration to turn into a death sentence.
So you've reduced the inmate population in the San Francisco jail by about 40%, and I think the number is now approximately like 750, 760, something like that. What did you do to reduce the population?
Basically, what we did, Terry, was we analyzed the entire jail population in numerous different segments or slices. We came up with lists of people who met certain criteria that we wanted to focus on, either identifying for release or finding ways to expedite their release if possible. So, for example, we looked at inmates who were elderly. We looked at inmates who were incarcerated for misdemeanors. We looked at inmates who had been conserved and were simply in jail waiting for placement in an appropriate mental health facility. We looked at veterans. We looked at people who were being held simply because of their inability to pay a low bail amount. We looked at people who had already been sentenced and had an upcoming release date in the next couple of months. We looked at people who were incarcerated just because of a technical violation of probation or parole, and so on. One of the things that's interesting that we found in this process, Terry, is that it is in fact possible to safely and quickly decarcerate. We found a lot of people who, it turns out, shouldn't have really been incarcerated in the first place. For example, we had a mother who was conserved and was simply waiting for placement in an appropriate mental health facility. We were able to get her placement expedited rather than having her wait in jail for months on end, as is often the case. We had another young woman with a high-risk pregnancy with no criminal record who was in jail on a misdemeanor. With our reentry partners, we were able to get that expecting mother into a prenatal care facility where she can stay safely until her birth. Those are the kinds of people that make me wonder whether we were doing enough before this epidemic to reduce the jail population and to reduce our reliance on incarceration as a first response to so many of our social problems.
So you are an advocate of criminal justice reform, and among the reforms that you have advocated and begun to undertake is changing the bail system so that instead of cash bail, whether you get to stay out of jail while you're awaiting trial is based on risk and not on wealth. How far are you along in trying to do that in San Francisco?
The problem with money bail, for those who aren't familiar with it, is that it puts a price tag on freedom. It says to someone who is wealthy that no matter how dangerous you are, you can buy your way out. And it says to someone who is poor that no matter how frivolous the charges against you, no matter how innocent you may be, no matter how strong your ties to the community and how low risk you may be, because of your poverty, you're going to languish behind bars. In San Francisco, I'm proud to say that one of my first mandates as district attorney was that my staff would never ask the court to impose money bail. If we believe someone is too dangerous to be released, then it doesn't matter how wealthy they are, we should ask the court to detain them. And if we believe that someone can safely be released to their community, then we should ask the court for whatever conditions or orders are necessary to ensure public safety with that person being released, consistent with the presumption of innocence, consistent with the Supreme Court mandate that liberty is the norm.
William Barr, Attorney General, has expanded early release of inmates in prisons that have large outbreaks in Louisiana, Connecticut, and Ohio. But he also wrote, the last thing our massively overburdened police forces need right now is the indiscriminate release of thousands of prisoners into the streets without any verification that those prisoners will follow the laws when released. Do you share his concerns?
Well, when framed that way, I do share it. But I think the key here is indiscriminate. What we're doing in San Francisco and what we're doing with other criminal justice partners across the state and across the country is anything but indiscriminate. We are being careful, we are being focused and surgical in our efforts to decrease the jail population. We are identifying people like my father, frankly, who are extremely low risk, who present no risk of public safety. When you see people like that who are incarcerated, not because of a public safety risk, but simply because of a commitment to vengeance and a punitive approach to criminal justice, you realize that we can quickly and safely reduce our jail and prison populations. And so what we're doing in San Francisco is not releasing people who are committing crimes, but rather people who can safely be released with the right supervision, the right support, the right structures. And we see that in the statistics on the street. Compared to March of 2019, this past month has seen a decrease in crime of approximately 40%. So we're both decreasing the jail population and seeing a parallel decrease in crime rates.
That was Chesa Boudin, San Francisco's district attorney. Dr. Justin Coles is a professor at the Fordham University Graduate School of Education with an emphasis on urban education and critical race studies. Dr. Coles co-authored an article on mass suspensions of Black students, a long-standing phenomenon that Coles says is a relic of slavery and Jim Crow.
It's interesting that we are having this conversation in this current moment, right, particularly when we're thinking about the COVID-19 crisis and sort of how just the way disproportionality is seen in every aspect of Black U.S. life. And so, yeah, just those stats, just repeating them again, this idea that Black children represent 15.5% of all public school students, but 30% of students suspended from school. And again, as you mentioned, the preschool stats for me, even being more alarming, Black children representing only 19% of preschool students, but somehow, again, representing 47% of those students being suspended. And yes, yeah, so as you mentioned, what we try to do in this paper, Tanette Powell, who is a PhD student at UCLA, who just defended her dissertation, we're really trying to examine the root of this, which is anti-Blackness, right? And so, again, there are behaviors that students do, right, across all races that may be warranted as bad, quote unquote. But again, what we're really trying to explicate behaviors. And so what we are finding, of course, is that when Black children do behaviors that are consistent with or sort of appropriate at their age level, somehow because of sort of the ways that we in this world have conceptualized Blackness as just always negative, right, those behaviors are the ones that are punished more, which account for that disproportionality. And sort of those are the ones that often suffer. And as you mentioned here, we're sort of talking about that social suffering. The latest stat that I heard was like, in New Orleans specifically, 70% of the people who are dying from it are Black people. And in New Orleans, they only make about 1/3 of that population. And so I'm really connecting the way disproportionality works out, whether it's around punishment or health, is mirrored in our educational institutions, all from that sort of underlying ideal of anti-Blackness, again, stemming from just the ways that the U.S. has imagined Black people as essentially like outside the realms of humanity.
And those statistics concerning school suspensions, you say, amount to symbolic violence against Black kids.
Right. And so this is sort of the crux of this argument that Sunette and I were making. This idea of symbolic violence, again, we were really pulling it from sort of Perdue's notion of symbolic violence, which essentially is just this idea that certain forms of oppression, they happen so often and so routine that they become normalized. And we wake up one day and it just becomes our sort of everyday business as usual. And since it has been around so long, it becomes a part of us, and we adopt it and we expect it and we no longer sort of question it. And even as you mentioned at the start of the call, right, you know, disproportionality and suspension is essentially as old as U.S. education as we know it. Black children have always been pushed out and excluded from schools. And so the symbolic violence part, the danger of it is that it is a violence, but it's such a subtle and diffuse violence that sort of Black children, their families, sort of, and even the teachers who teach them, they start to sort of enact this violence. It is expected. And the dangerous part of symbolic violence that we write about in this paper is this idea of misrecognition, particularly when we think about all these ideals of multiculturalism and colorblindness, et cetera. Black youth can often buy into these ideas of, you know what, maybe it is my individual fault that I'm being suspended because these are the rules. What they're doing is misrecognizing that it's not particularly about their individual behaviors, but there is this larger system of anti-Blackness. And so the goal in this, through these stories and this paper, is to document youth voices. That way they themselves might start to recognize the ways suspension has just become seen as this thing like, oh, of course, right, Black students are suspended more because they're bad. And we're trying to really get them in educators' paper to disrupt that commonplace ideal that we know for sure is not common, but has been made that way by sort of structures.
Every teacher should know, and I think almost every kid knows, that suspension from school is often the first and very big step towards being excluded from education entirely and winding up on the other side of the criminal justice system. And one thinks, looking at those statistics, that that is part of the plan.
Right. I'm glad you kind of got it here to this idea of the plan. Michael Dumas, who is a scholar at UC Berkeley, he, in one of his articles, you know, he sort of lays out this ideal how schooling is essentially a setup for the Black community in the U.S. and that it's a setup that sort of Black children were never really meant to overcome, right? It's this plan. And so when we think about, I mean, we can go all the way back to earlier educational scholars like Carter G. Woodson, right, in The Miseducation of the Negro. People have long documented this plan, this setup. And despite that, because, as you know, and I'm sure many listeners know, rightfully so, for the Black community, since slavery, even before that, education has always served as the site of hope. Black folks have a folk faith in education because we do see it as a liberatory site. And so I guess our goal is to sort of wrestle, and in this paper, we try to wrestle with it. What does it mean to still believe in the liberatory powers of education, but to consider what that means in the structure of anti-Blackness, with us knowing that literally the design of schooling in a slave society, as Glenn Lowry would say, is just never meant for Black youth to survive, or at least to survive in ways that we might conceptualize sort of non-Black children too, and white children specifically.
You write that blackness, I guess in terms of the blackness as perceived by teachers and other school authorities, blackness is imagined as disturbing the peace.
Yeah, I'll answer this question by bringing in a story that always has troubled me within U.S. history. And there are countless stories, right? But there is this chapter that I wrote that I'd be happy to share with you. And essentially, it's called The Cost of Whistling, Orange Juice, and Skittles. And it's this sort of analysis where I discuss the extrajudicial debt. We have Orange Juice, which was Latasha Harlan, and then we have Skittles, which was Trayvon Martin. And in all of those instances, we see the ways Black youth were conceptualized as disturbing the peace. But I think specifically the one that troubles me the most, Latasha Harlan, was a Black girl who was essentially going into a store to buy orange juice and did in fact have money and was going to pay. However, the Korean store clerk accosted her and thought she was stealing. And then in her effort, in Latasha's effort to insert peace and to show that she was being a peaceful person, she decided to put the orange juice on the counter and to leave, right, to de-escalate the situation. On her way out, she's hit by this Korean store owner. And the jury, shockingly, actually wanted to convict the store owner. And they were giving her sort of quite an amount of years in prison. However, the white female judge overturned that jury's decision and decided that this Korean woman had already suffered enough. And so here we get this sort of picture of Black youth, Black people, Black humanity as actually always having been peaceful. And even when they really don't need to be, they still try to insert peace. But because of the ways that Blackness has historically been socially constructed as dangerous, as backwards, right? Like, no matter what, whatever situation, thereby heightened sense that something may go awry. And for no other reason, because now Blackness has entered the scene. And so in this paper, taking all of this sort of this history and the roots of sort of the ways Blackness has been imagined in the public imaginary, what we are saying is that this disproportionality is not by happenstance, but it's literally because the roots of schooling, right? We can think back to even the image of Elizabeth Eckford, right? In Arkansas, like people screaming at her to get into the school. We just know that when Black bodies enter space, they are disturbing this peace, right? This sort of white mythical peace that has come to frame U.S. life and U.S. education that lie at the root of why Black kids are thought of as disturbing the peace.
Yes, so many studies, yours and others, wind up analyzing the ways and imaginations of white folks, because they are the roots of these crazy systems that keep on producing Black failure and Black disabilities. And in that vein, you cite others who have said that Black youth are viewed, and I assume you mean by whites, as capable of coping with higher levels of pain and suffering. And there's also been observations that in the medical profession, doctors seem to feel that Black people in general, and Black women in particular, can also cope with excessive pain. These have to be racial attitudes that go back to slave time.
That is 100% true, one, the history of this. It's interesting how schools, historically, particularly when we think about urban schools that serve largely Black students, they see these schools as these sort of sites of oasis, right, in the midst of Black neighborhoods, that these schools will be the ones that will save Black students from violence. But meanwhile, as we know, or as research has documented, schools themselves are sort of these gross sites of violence. And one of the major ways that this violence is enacted is through the ways that we think that students, Black students specifically, can handle higher levels of sort of pain and suffering. And in the school building specifically, what we talk about is the ways that Black students are meant to endure structural and equitable conditions think about what happened around 2016 in Detroit with the Detroit Sick Outs, where students and teachers were just documenting that the conditions were so unbearable in these schools, whether that meant there was mold growing or there was a lack of heat, but still they were expected to go. And so just like society and schools, we see the same way. It's like, oh, Black kids, of course, can handle bad school conditions, old textbooks, dilapidated classrooms, unqualified or uncertified teachers. And that's okay, right? Because they can. And we know that non-Black children, whether urban areas or not, would never be expected to handle those sort of sufferings in their educational experience. And so there's this idea that I like to call institutional mirroring. So the exact ways that we imagine Black folks to experience and sort of tread through suffering with a smile on their face in society is exactly what we expect them to do in schools. And so the goal here is to think about how do we, again, counter that or disrupt that.
Yes. What kind of interventions are needed to prevent these excessive suspensions?
In this paper, we sort of organize our work around two larger sort of ideals. One is sort of structural unfairness, and then the other one is an equitable outcome. So I'll focus on like the structural interventions first. And so the biggest thing that we say is that we know that all schools use suspensions, right, as a tool. Number one intervention is for educators, particularly school leaders, to do a deep analysis of their suspension data, as long as they can go back, track those trends and patterns, and sort of identify what we know, what the research says, right, the disproportionality in Black students, and then to really sort of reevaluate what is the purpose of suspension, if it has anything to do with just like these random ideas of like, oh, we just need law and order. Sort of we urge them to think about how law and order in the context of the U.S. is just always going to be inherently anti-Black. And for them to really reimagine new ways to get at their goals, right, that aren't rooted in sort of the marginalization of Black bodies through suspension. Structural intervention is for educators and school leaders to literally reflect and challenge their perspective of why sort of school suspension is a default punitive practice that they rely on much. And now, because the second one I'll go into around the structure is, as I've mentioned, from Carter G. Woodson to this paper that we wrote, the primary intervention for us is to actually get youth to, Black youth, to cultivate and adopt a political analysis for themselves. That way they can counter the misrecognition of anti-Blackness. That way they go into schools or even moving through society understanding that there is nothing wrong with their Blackness, right? I think that is very destructive. And so, again, those two high-level interventions for us are, one, literally equipping educators and school leaders to do that high-level analysis of why are school suspensions necessary and really eventually to sort of eradicate them. And then second is to arm Black youth with a political analysis. At least they now are able to name and sort of recognize that and challenge their school site in ways that sort of allow them to lean into their humanization, despite the ways that school suspensions will probably, even after, you know, I'm done sort of here in this world, will continue to dehumanize them. America, both its schools and other institutions, operates in ahistoricism. And so in our work, what we started to realize is that a lot of people were documenting suspension disproportionality and discipline in the contemporary moment only, and then kind of trying to find solutions starting in the contemporary moment, which is ahistorical. And so I think what's going to be important for particularly the disproportionate suspension of Black youth, or really any ills that plague Black children in school, is to reject ahistoricism and to do a deep dive into how historical moments and periods, or really historical structures, are literally responsible for the current, will we be able to really do some impactful work moving forward, again, because we're really explicating the roots of the issues. And so here in this paper, again, we were theorizing concept of discipline independent of school suspensions in the U.S. as connected to a legacy of Black codes and then to the Jim Crow era and then to the contemporary era of mass incarceration. And we felt that work was necessary. And if anything, I just want to urge folks as they sort of are thinking about contemporary issues to always, again, dig back to that. And Christina Sharp has this wonderful book called In the Wake on Blackness and Being, and she sort of frames it as we are currently living in the wake of slavery. And as we know, slavery was not just an event, but it's a structure. So I think it's important within the U.S., the continent U.S. specifically, when we are trying to make change Black life and Black education, that we sort of understand that we're sort of occupying this space of sort of the wake of Black folks existing as property.
Dr. Justin Coles, speaking from Fordham University in New York City. Race was the main force behind last year's coup that overthrew Evo Morales, the elected president of Bolivia, South America's most heavily indigenous nation. That's the assessment of Dr. Tathagatan Ravindran, a professor of anthropology and sociology in Colombia, who has done extensive research on Bolivia's indigenous majority. Dr. Ravindran says the United States and multinational corporations also had it in for Morales, but racism is what brought Bolivia's first native president down.
Yeah, that is true, because the whole coup has to do with a racist backlash against Evo Morales, his policies, and the whole process of indigenous revalorization and indigenous empowerment. So there are multiple interpretations of what happened during the coup. Yeah, it's a complicated situation, but my argument based on my experience of research in Bolivia is that it is mainly a product of racist backlash that has been brewing over the years against indigenous assertion. It's not only against Evo Morales and his politics, or it's not a coup against a person, Evo Morales. It's mainly a coup against indigenous resurgence Bolivia has witnessed and the challenge to existing racial hierarchies, right? So Bolivia has seen like the worst forms of structural racism for 5 centuries. And from the beginning of the 21st century, indigenous people took over the leadership of various social movements against neoliberal policies, and indigenous protagonism in these mobilizations played a major part in the downfall of the earlier neoliberal regimes and brought the first indigenous president to power. And that's really interesting because Bolivia is a country which is majority indigenous, but it's for the first time that Bolivia had an indigenous president. So, and the policies of the government too were something which led to indigenous empowerment. You have multiple perspectives on it, right? Because there are multiple indigenous voices and different indigenous sectors with different priorities. So yeah, there were some indigenous sectors who were not satisfied with his policies, who were against his policies, but there were many other indigenous sectors who constitute the majority of the indigenous population who benefited from his policies. And this created a major racist backlash on the part of the white mestizo elites. So what we saw in the days running up to the coup was the culmination of a long process of racial backlash. So I would read the coup as a consequence of racist backlash.
Now, from a Black United States point of view, the developments and history of Bolivia have all kinds of resonance with the term Jim Crow, only this time Native Americans on the bottom.
Exactly. It's very interesting because Bolivia had policies which are very similar to Jim Crow segregation policies. So indigenous people were not allowed to enter some spaces in the city like the central plazas and so on. And from the middle of the 20th century, there were major changes. There was a revolution in 1952, which promised to include indigenous people for the first time in the country, for the first time as citizens, as right-bearing citizens. And that's when the universal vote or a universal adult franchise was introduced in Bolivia, and there was agrarian reform and so on. But at the same time, informally, policies of segregation continued to be in place. So during the course of my research, I collected a lot of oral narrative indigenous. I worked in El Alto, which is a predominantly indigenous city. It is considered the largest indigenous city in the Americas and the most significant rebel city in Latin America. So I did my field work in the city and I collected many oral narratives from people of indigenous origin who had migrated from rural indigenous communities to the city of El Alto. So most of the narratives I came across first things like it was prohibited to speak our indigenous languages in public spaces. When we went to public offices, we were not allowed to enter the elite areas of the city. There was no formal prohibition, but in effect, it was like a formal prohibition. The speaking of indigenous languages was never formally prohibited, but the fact that most of them told me that it was prohibited reveals that there was a strong stigma to speaking indigenous languages. So in many cases, though you don't have formal laws, right, for laws imposing segregation, you see that segregation was an everyday practice. Indigenous people, especially the women wearing the poya skirt, were not allowed to enter some spaces in the city. For example, they were not allowed to enter five restaurants. They were allowed to enter most, you know, elite neighborhoods of the city. But in the last 20 years, what you said, that you go to a five-star restaurant, and in the restaurant, you can see indigenous women relishing a meal, right? And this is something unimaginable in the 20th century, at least till the end of the 20th century, it was unimaginable. So what we see now is a racist backlash against all these new developments, all these new forms of indigenous empowerment. So yeah, I even saw that during the course of my research, there was a severe resentment on the part of the white mestizo elites that indigenous people are occupying spaces, are invading spaces which were racially exclusive to them.
And so with this background of centuries of racial oppression, these symbolic things take on a huge importance. And terms like Weephala, which refers to the Native American associated flag, and Poyera, which is that skirt that Native American women wear, these take on huge symbolic values.
Exactly, they take on great symbolic value because, yeah, the Weephala is the flag of indigenous self-determination, and Evo Morales introduced it as one of the, you know, symbols of the fatherland. So it is, so along with the national flag, you find the Weephala everywhere. So on the presidential palace, you have the national flag, and beside the national flag, you have the Weephala. And Poyera is also a very important symbol. Yeah, Poyera is a skirt worn by indigenous women. But wearing a poyera was something really complicated in the previous century, right? Because women were discriminated just for wearing the poyera. Wearing the poyera was seen as a synonym of being ignorant, of being unhygienic, and so on. So something which happened in the previous 20 years was that you could see women wearing the poyera holding positions of power. So there were ministers who were women wearing the poyera for the first time. There were ambassadors. Right, women wearing the poyera became ambassadors, ministers. Women wearing the poyera became directors of institutions. Women wearing the poyera could be seen as journalists, right, presenting TV shows and so on. So there has been this assertion and revalorization of the poyera. So what happened in this context is that it's something which invited the backlash. For the white mestizo elites, somebody wearing the poyera occupying position of power is something equivalent to irresponsibility, because for them it was hard to imagine that a woman wearing the poyera would be able to, you know, run the affairs of the country and so on. So these symbols were very important. So after the coup, immediately after the coup, when Evo Morales was forced to resign, the organizers of the coup removed the Weephala from the presidential palace and burned it. And this created a huge reaction among the people, because for the people, Weephala was something more than just a flag. Weephala was something which symbolized whatever happened in the previous 20 years. It symbolized a reversal of 500 years of history, or something, as if something was beginning to change. It was not that everything changed, that racism still persisted, but for them, it was a major change. It was the beginning of a change, and it was the beginning of a hope for a different kind of future. So when the Weephala was removed from the presidential palace and burned, the people reacted very furiously. So immediately after the Weephala was burned, you saw mobilizations breaking out in different parts of the city of La Paz and El Alto, no? Especially the indigenous neighborhoods. People took over police stations, and there were marches asking for civil war, where people were gritting, were shouting, no, civil war, civil war. And once there was this meeting of the Union of Transport, it's a union of drivers of minibuses. We are owners of minibuses and basically a union of rural transporters, rural drivers. So in that meeting, one of them argued that burning the Vipala forest signifies a return to the past, which means a return to those years when they were severely discriminated against, where they were treated as second-class citizens. So the burning of the Vipala had such a huge symbolic significance for the people. So that's why one of the major chants during the mobilizations against the coup was, the Vipala should be respected, damn it, and the Poyera should be respected, damn it.
Now, we don't want to give the impression that the Morales government was all about symbolism. Actually, the oil and gas reserves of the country were put more at the service of broad masses of the people. And the oil and gas companies paid a bigger share of their profits, which led to a period of prosperity in Bolivia.
Exactly, yeah, it's not all symbolic. There are some arguments which say that Evo Morales was all about symbolism and there weren't significant material benefits, but that's not true. So what we see is that, for example, the material benefits for the indigenous population are significant. I can refer to some studies very briefly. There's an economic trick study of economist Hicks. So he points out that indigenous population of Bolivia achieved a rapid catch-up in income and expenditure relative to the non-indigenous population, which enabled the former to approximately close one quarter of the interracial gap in income in the pre-Morales era. So even in the course of my field work, in my interviews with the people, a lot of them told me of changes in their rural countryside, in their rural communities. So for example, the construction of roads, the kilometers of roads constructed under the Morales government quadrupled, right? And there were significant reductions in poverty and inequality. And that is mainly because of the nationalization of gas, nationalization of the hard hydrocarbons. So yeah, it was a partial nationalization which involved an increase in the royalties the gas companies pay the state. And the government could use the additional revenue generated from that to finance social welfare schemes, to finance universities, to make direct cash transfers and so on. And that had significant material impacts because it not just gave additional income to the people, but it also generated more demand. And generation of more demand and the demand stimulus is something which increases productivity and kickstarts the economy. So for the past 5 years, Bolivia is a Latin American country which has the highest rate of economic growth.
And has the coup regime sought to reverse those nationalizations and other reforms?
Yes, after the coup, though the government which took over declared that it's just a government of transition and they would just be there for a few months to conduct elections, what they actually did was the first things they did was to reverse the economic policies and the foreign policies of the Morales government. So once the Minister of the Economy declared that his aim is to privatize, right, nationalized enterprises. They haven't been able to do so, but one way they have been trying to do is to destroy public sector companies. For example, there is a national airline, a public sector airline called BOA. And what the government is trying to do is to destroy the industry, right, in alliance with another private sector airline to show that all these public sector companies are running on deficit, they are inefficient, and to create justifications for their privatization. Public investment has also gone down. It's just a few months into the new regime, but public investment has gone down. So the idea is to basically reverse all the anti-neoliberal policies initiated by the Morales administration and go back to neoliberal policies. And the current president is once again running for office, and her vice presidential candidate declared that he would not create more public sector enterprises because in the 90s, he was a minister of planification. And he had become infamous in Bolivia because when he was a minister, he declared that his plan was to privatize one public sector company every week.
And now all eyes are on lithium, that vital mineral that Bolivia has in great abundance.
Yes, and that was a major issue in the coup because Evo Morales wanted to industrialize lithium because a major problem with extractivist policies is that you export raw materials, and then you end up in greater poverty because you export raw materials and then you import processed goods and then you lose out. That has been the old critique made by dependency theory and so on. So what Evo Morales decided is that we would industrialize those natural resources and not just export primary products. So the industrialization of gas has already begun. And Evo Morales' plan was that, yeah, lithium would be industrialized. It would be value would be added on before being exported. And Evo Morales wanted it to be a joint sector enterprise where more than 50% of the shares of the company which exploits lithium would stay within the public sector. And what happened was that the multinational corporations were not in favor of it. And so I think this is a major factor which played a role in the coup, because lithium is the mineral of the future. And Bolivia is supposed to have 70% of the world's lithium.
Now, we know that many journalists, especially progressive journalists, have been run out of Bolivia. So we don't get a regular look at what's happening on the ground, especially in that heroic city, El Alto, that you were talking about.
Yes. Like, what the government did was to control all mainstream media outlets, right? So that, in that regard, their policies are similar to the military dictatorships of the 70s and 80s. The Minister of Communication once declared that he would try to control the media outlets which propagate information against the government, right? Which they would be charged with sedition and terrorism. And this had the impact of silencing the mainstream media. So the only ones who, so even I got most of the information through alternative media outlets. Some of my friends who were there on the streets participating in the mobilizations who recorded whatever happened on their cell phones and then uploaded it on social networking sites. And there were many other small alternative informal media outlets, right? So thanks to the cell phone and the possibilities of recording, that's how we got to know a lot of things which are happening over there. And for the rural communities, the communitarian radio stations have been, for decades, they have functioned as the main sources of information. So one thing the government did was to close down. 53 communitarian radio stations were closed down. Some of their installations were burned so that people don't get access to the information. So for some time, it was only international, the international media was the only presence in Bolivia, right? So there were Russia Today, there was Telesur, and the government decided to take Telesur off air. Then some journalists came in from Argentina to cover some of the happenings, and what happened is that the government forced them to leave, threatened them, and they also had to leave the country. So there are very few sources of information from mainstream media outlets, but the only sources of information we have are from informal media outlets, informal networks, and basically people who record whatever happens on their cell phones and post it on social networking sites. So thanks to that, we have a lot of information. For example, currently in the context of the outbreak of COVID-19, there has been an intensification of racial hatred in Bolivia. So the white mestizo discourse has been to blame indigenous people for not respecting the quarantine, for not staying indoors. And so indigenous people have been portrayed as a risk, right, as a health risk for the white mestizo population.
There was supposed to be an election on May 3rd, but that's been postponed because of the coronavirus. But whenever that election does occur, would one expect it to be free and fair in any respect?
It's really difficult because, for example, the USAID is an organization which is actively involved in the elections. And that is really worrying. And even the new electoral court and the people who run it are not very trustworthy. So, for example, the process of the registration of new voters, a lot of them were excluded. A lot of people, mainly like Morales supporters and the MAS supporters, were excluded because the new electoral court has acted very partially, right, with a lot of bias in the whole process. So a lot of people have already been excluded. And so it's really difficult to ensure or guarantee that the elections would be free and fair. And that's really worrying.
And if those elections are not free and fair, can we expect a response from El Alto and other indigenous population centers?
Yeah, I'm totally sure of that. So if the elections are not free and fair, there would be mobilizations all over Bolivia, mainly centered on indigenous popular parts of the country. Because the mobilization, Bolivia has a long history of mobilizations. In 2003 and 2005, mobilizations are able to force two presidents to resign, and one of them had to flee the country. So Bolivia has this huge capacity, extraordinary capacity of mobilizing people. So even after the coup, the mobilizations were very strong. And it is just the promise of elections and the possibility that there could be free and fair elections which helped in calming the people, right? So people were expecting that, yeah, there would be elections and they would get a chance to express themselves during the elections and choose their representatives and choose the president. So that's the only thing which helped Bolivia return to a normal situation after the coup, because there were mobilizations each and every day and there were massacres which were going on. So if the elections are not free and fair, then yeah, the people of El Alto and the other rural provinces, they would not remain quiet, because there is a lot at stake. There is a lot at stake for the elites, right, for the opposition parties, the old neoliberal opposition parties, and also for the indigenous popular sectors. They have a lot to lose, and they are not used to remaining quiet and submissive when something like this happens.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.